is Amy Hall here with Greg Kokel, and you're listening to the hashtag STRask podcast from Stand to Reason. And we're here to answer your questions. So we thank you for sending those questions, and we could not do this without you. We look forward to hearing from you every week, and we love answering your questions. So please keep this show going and send those in. Okay, Greg, here's a question from Tony. Since remarriage after a divorce is considered adultery, does this imply that God considers the couple to still be married? If so, what are the implications? For instance, if the couple reconciled, could they resume sexual activity without committing sin?
I always approach questions like this with fear and trembling. And the reason is I think they're hard to resolve. Now, one could, in a certain sense, take a very kind of rigid approach to this and say, well, there's no possibility of remarriage after divorce under any circumstances, because that would result in adultery. And I actually don't think that's the case. I think there are explicit exceptions to that. But what of this statement then? If, for example, like Paul seems to indicate, if a non-believer leaves the believer, there's an abandonment or desertion, then I don't think that obligation is sustained there. You know, God's called us to peace. If they want to go, then they can go. And the language, the way he words it, indicates to me that the believer is free to remarry after that. But it would still be the case that they are not marrying, I'm sorry, that they are entering into a relationship in which they will have sex with someone other than their original spouse. And so there is a violation of a standard there. There's an inconsistency in there. And so this is where, you know, I can say in a sense there is adultery going on because you're having sex with someone other than your original spouse. But it doesn't seem to have the same moral ramifications if there is an acceptable circumstance that justifies remarriage. And one, it seems that in the case of marital infidelity, that Jesus is making an exception there as well. Now, some have said, well, the reason why remarriage is not an example of adultery under those circumstances is because adultery has already been committed. But that makes sense in a way. But even so, maybe adultery has already been committed by one person, which justifies divorcing them and marrying someone else. But now you're in a new relationship in which that's not the original relationship. So there's a kind of adultery going on there. So this is why I think this issue is kind of messy. And notice it only talks about the woman in that case. It doesn't talk about the man. Jesus addresses the woman, okay? You're forcing the woman into adultery. It doesn't make any reference to the man. I'm just making an observation. I'm not drawing conclusions right now based on that, but that is a little bit odd. So there may be a case to be made that what Jesus is talking about is the violation of an ideal that has moral consequences. You know, when you are, adultery's wrong. That means you're having sex with somebody other than your spouse. And if you get divorced and remarry, then you have sex with someone other than your original spouse, and that isn't what God had in mind. Now, there are some times that that's the lesser of two evils or something like that, and Jesus is talking about some exceptional circumstances, but it isn't certainly what God ordained from the beginning. And this is why he goes back to the beginning, one man with one woman becoming one flesh for one lifetime, and that's what God has in mind. So I think there's a case to be made for seeing it in that way. All right. But fear and trembling, I think it's hard to figure all of that out. I do think that most divorces are not justified. This is my suspicion. They are not. It's like, oh, we have irreconcilable differences. So we don't like each other. So, okay, you made a promise. Okay, do the things that you promised to do. Love, cherish, whatever. And okay, so this is going to cause problems. There is a, with some people, with for me, or about me, there's a pecking order, you know? So if Amy, you said, well, I don't like my boss, all right, but you still work for me and I'm still the boss, even if you don't like me, you know? And so because there is a pecking order and I'm the boss of this organization, kind of, then, you know, the organization still is able to function even if some people don't like the fact that they work for me, because there is a hierarchy. And I think the same is true about families. What ends up happening, though, and I think this is the influence of the culture a lot, is at least in some cases, that women are buying into a different value system. All right. And so they're not reading Titus, and they're not reading Ephesians 5. They're not reading 1 Peter chapter 3. And I know that husbands have responsibilities as well, and I'm not disregarding that. But I think sometimes we have irreconcilable differences. And what that means is I want it my way and he wants it a different way. And we couldn't reconcile that. So we're splitting up. Well, the way to reconcile it is the person who is in charge gets the final call. That's the way it always works in circumstances like this. So this is one of the reasons I say that a lot of these relationships are and divorces are not licit. They're illicit. They should not have taken place. And if you're facing a circumstance where you're not going to get out of this relationship, that's a huge incentive to try to make it a better relationship, you know, and follow the rules, because God's rules are good rules. They are connected to him and flourishing. And when we do things God's way, then we flourish. When we don't, we don't.
Well, first off, Greg, you can rest easy because I do like you, so you don't have to worry about that. Secondly, I also wanted to point out that because I did take notice of this, because I had noticed that Jesus said the woman committed adultery, but in Mark 10, he does say the man commits adultery. Whoever divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. So he does in that.
I see. Okay, passage. Good. Well, thank you for that clarification. Mm-hmm.
But what I suspect is going on here is what the Pharisees were doing is divorcing their wife for any and every reason to marry another person. So what they were doing is, I would like to be married. I would like to be with this other person. Therefore, I'll just divorce this person and marry this other person. Now, in their minds, since they were following the law given by Moses, that was hunky-dory. You just follow the law. But in reality, I think what Jesus was saying here is that's adultery. All you're doing is just getting a piece of paper so you can go be with this other woman instead of just going there before getting divorced. So I suspect it's somewhere like saying hating someone in your heart is murdering them. Well, it's not actually murdering them, but the principle is the same here. So having said that, I do not think you are still married if you get divorced. And one reason why I think this is that in the Old Testament, if you divorce your wife, you marry another person, you can't go back to her. There is a new marriage. You are truly married to the new person. It's not a fake marriage. Mm-hmm. God considers it a real marriage, even if it in the spirit of adultery by leaving your wife and marrying someone else. So I think the Bible does indicate that you are not still married if you get divorced, and therefore you cannot resume sexual activity without committing sin. I do think you would need to get married in order to actually be married. Even if, and I say this, even if the divorce and remarriage is illegitimate, I still think there is something to committing to someone and making that promise that makes the new marriage an actual marriage, even if it shouldn't have taken place. Does that sound
reasonable? Well, there's a parallel,
Greg?
Amy. Yeah, there's a parallel if Paul says not to be unequally yoked, a non-believer and a believer should not get married together, for example. If they do, though, even though the action was wrong, it's not what God wants, they still now have a real marriage, and it would be wrong for them to dissolve that union. Okay, now they're married. Okay, so now it's God's will for them to stay married, even though it wasn't God's will for them to get married, morally speaking, God's will. So maybe there's a parallel with the circumstance we're talking about.
Like you said, Greg, this is really messy. There are so many different moral things involved with breaking your promise and making a new one. And do you keep that? It's all very messy. So I agree with you, Greg. Fear and trembling on this topic for sure. Let's take a question from Alan. Could you support and vote for a national political candidate who is most aligned with your political views but is openly transgender?
Well, the simple answer is, in principle, yes, but it would depend on some other issues. Okay, and I've made this point actually regarding other more weighty moral issues like abortion, all right? And I think what our obligation is as Christian voters is not to have like one issue. I will never vote for a person who affirms X, all right? And the reason why we shouldn't do that, kind of like that's a blanket criterion, is because by saying I will not vote for a person who believes X, I may, in not voting for that person, actually encourage X to happen. Now, that sounds odd until you look at the nature of politics and suffrage in the United States of America, all right? We have a a two-party system. And that means that for all intents and purposes, either a Republican or a Democrat is going to be elected in major elections. All right. Now, I know in one case, for example, in California, where there was a strong contender for the Senate who was a Republican. All right. And that person, I can't remember his name, but there were a lot of people who objected. Christians objected to voting for that Republican because he was pro-choice. All right. Now, it turns out that no senator is, you know, certainly in that period of time, this was maybe 15 years ago, 20 years ago, possibly, no senator is going to really have any impact on the issue of abortion because it's not a legislative issue. It wasn't then. Okay. But it was a judicial issue. But if you have a Republican president, and you have another Republican senator, you have a dynamic that makes it easier for the president, who was pro-life, to get judicially conservative appointments to the courts, which the senator would have a role in affirming even if he didn't agree with their personal politics. He's got another motivation to affirm them because it's his president, his party's president, that is making the And he may be a judicial conservative, even though personally he's more liberal with regards to an issue like abortion. So here's the rule then. If instead of saying I will never vote for a person who X, because in well, what ended up happening in that particular case, let me finish out the narrative, is that the Republican did not get elected. And I'm not sure if it would have made a difference if more Christians voted for him or not, but because this was California after all. But a lot of Christians didn't. There was a campaign against him because he's not pro-life, and I will never vote for a non-pro-life candidate, this kind of thing. When if they would have voted for that non-pro-life candidate, they would have had actually a bigger influence on pro-life policy, arguably, in this country, than if they just backed off and voted for some other candidate who is unelectable. They wasted their vote, in my view, on that. Well, I'm not going to violate my conscience. Wait a minute. What is the obligation of your conscience right now? And this is the way I would put it. The obligation of your conscience is to do the most good with your vote. To do the most good with your vote. If you can cast a vote in a close race that is going to get a less morally offensive candidate into office than would otherwise take place if you didn't vote or a whole bunch of people like you didn't vote. If you can make a difference there, well, then you've done a good thing because you've diminished the amount of evil that is going to take place as a result of a candidate. All right. And but if you say, well, I'm not going to sully myself marking the box for somebody who's got character qualities or beliefs or principles or policies that I don't approve of, okay, don't do that. And what's ended up happening then is it might be the worst person gets elected because you chose not to do that. So this is what I suggest to people. Your policy should be, as a Christian, a follower of Christ, when I exercise my vote, I use my vote to accomplish the greatest good possible in the circumstance. I don't become, in a certain sense, in a very legalistic way, a one-issue voter. Obviously, I think that the notion of abortion is really critical. But I think slavery is critical, too. And what if I had two people that were pro-slavery, all right? But one person was pro-slavery and wanted to expand slavery into the North and would work to do that if got elected. The other one didn't want to do that. Well, then it would be the second that would be, since these are the only two realistic candidates for this role, I should vote for the one that would do the less damage. And in so doing, I would be doing something good. If I withheld my vote not to sully myself on this view by voting for somebody who believed in slavery, then what I would be doing is I would be acting in a way that potentially would cause more slavery, not less slavery. So that's the criterion, just to come back to it. My vote should be used to look at both candidates and ask, what candidate can I vote for, given that these are the only two realistic candidates, that will accomplish the greatest good? That's the criterion, and take it from there. Therefore, in application, very simply now, with a transgender person, I mean, I don't like the fact that I would kind of, in a certain sense, affirm a transgender person, but it might be that this transgender person, actually, this is stipulated in the question, has all of the same policy concerns that I have, and would labor to pass all of these laws to do what's good and right and true in all these areas, even though in their own life they're confused about this gender issue and may advance pro-transgender legislation in some way. I don't know if that wasn't really on the thing, but all the other policy issues, I wouldn't disqualify a person like that, especially if they were with me on all these other morally significant things. That would be kind of a foolish legalism in my view.
Well, just to clarify in the question, he says, who is most aligned with their political views, which it's unclear how much they're aligned, but they're more aligned
how
than the other
that
person.
Was. Okay.
So, Greg, I agree with you that in our vote, we're trying to either prevent the greatest damage or, you know, pick the better of the two options. So I just want to bring out some considerations I would have, because as I was weighing those options, I would be weighing the damage that having a transgender person in that position would cause, as well as the damage of the other person's positions. So in a real world situation, I mean, I think this can be really complicated. And so what I want to make clear is, I don't think either of us, certainly not you, certainly not me, is saying that a transgender man is sinning, so therefore we can't vote for that person. And I'll just refer to a man here just to make this simpler. That would not be my consideration here necessarily, that it's just because he's sinning that therefore I can't vote for him. And it's not about I hate a transgender person, so therefore I can't vote for him. It's about
or a gay candidate, openly gay, or an openly gay candidate either, for that matter, or even a person who's been married a bunch of times. And there are all kinds of sin that you could point at in somebody's life.
Right. That's definitely something that's going to come up with many different kinds of people. But what makes this hypothetical difficult is that I think it's almost contradictory to imagine a political candidate who would align with my political views and be openly transgender. And the reason why I say that is because there's an important fundamental worldview difference between us. And it's not only a fundamental worldview difference, but it's a difference that's extremely relevant to politics right now. And that is our view of the human person. Is the human person completely malleable so that we can create ourselves, so that we can create who we are? Is there no pattern that we're supposed to conform to? Is there no human nature that we are supposed to submit to? Those ideas about the nature of the human person show up in all sorts of different policies, and policies I care about very much. So the idea that somebody would be living as a transgender person and share these policies that I care about seems very unlikely to me. And even if he were to state that was his position, I would know, you know, positions that are affected by that. I would know that he wouldn't have a grounding for those positions because his view of the human person wouldn't support the positions that I have. So his positions mm-hmm. could be very tenuous. He could change his mind if it's not grounded in some sort of worldview that supports it. And I just think about, for example, abortion. If human beings are not intrinsically valuable and have a human nature and do not become human beings because of their ability to create themselves, and I mean, it's just a completely different worldview. So, mm-hmm. so that's my first consideration. Secondly, his positions aren't the only things that will affect society. Just by living as a woman, he is constantly communicating to society something that is really harmful about human nature and something that will change people's view of human beings and what makes us human. And, expressive individualism and the malleable nature of human beings. So even if his positions are aligning with mine in many ways, he is constantly preaching that to our society. And that is something that will affect our society just as his positions mm-hmm. would. And worse, he could change the views of the people in the party, which means that we could lose that vehicle for good over time because people, as they adopt this view of human nature that is taking over our entire culture, we could lose that ability to have these policies in the future. So there are a lot of considerations. I would have to weigh mm-hmm. all of these things against the damage of the other side in any specific mm-hmm. situation. So it's not as simple as I disagree with transgenderism, therefore I can't vote. There are a lot of things to consider. And it's also not as simple as, well, it's everybody sins, therefore I can vote for him. I think there's a lot of things going on here with the worldview mm-hmm. and what his lifestyle is communicating to the world that you have to take into consideration.
Yeah, those are really, really good points. And your starting point is just because he's transgender does not disqualify him out of the gate. But then you have to look at these other consequences. And if his view of reality is thoroughly coherent, which oftentimes it isn't, and he's a very thoroughgoing in the way he applies the principles of his approach to transgender to other things as well, like you're saying, what does it mean to be human? Well, this is going to have ramifications in a lot of areas, like you said. It's somewhat of a rare bird who is consistent like that and does that, although it's not impossible. And so this is why in any given case, you have to look at the whole picture. And so there was a presidential candidate who was a homosexual, who was married according to the law. And to me, this would have been, as you pointed out in the second point, a very, very powerful statement about to the rest of the country about what is good and what is normal and what is acceptable, all right? And so that has to be taken into consideration. What you're pointing out, Amy, is that sometimes these issues are very complex. I the illustration I gave of the senatorial candidate in the state of California. I can't remember his name. He's, I think, Chinese, Michael something or other. But that struck me as more cut and dried. But still, you know, especially as the nature of the culture and the values and the spirit of the age, all of that stuff has changed so radically. It's become much more complicated, especially with transgender, because that seems to mean that a person has bought into a whole constellation of other things about the nature of reality that are going to have ramifications on the policy considerations that they address when they're in office. So, yeah, all that has to be taken into consideration. But would you say that it sounds like you're saying the basic principle, do the greater good or the lesser evil, however you want to characterize it, is a good principle, but sometimes that's going to be much more difficult to figure out in a given case.
Yeah, and I think there could be instances where I would vote for neither. I think that's possible. If I think that voting for either one would cause damage, or maybe I think that's equally damaging and I don't want to contribute to changing my own party. But, you know, could there be a situation where I would vote for a transgender person despite all these damages? Well, sure. What if he was running against Hitler? I mean, that's an extreme example, but there could be, there could be an example. But even though it's theoretically possible because of the fundamental differences in our worldviews, it's hard for me to imagine that kind of a situation happening in the real world. So it seems to be purely hypothetical to me. Mm-hmm. Well, Greg, we're out of time. Thank you for your thoughts.
Fancy that.
All right. Thank you. Yes, thank you, everyone, for your conversation. Thank you, Tony. Thank you, Alan. Thank you, listeners. Please send us your questions on Twitter or through our website with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.